2-5-1-0.
Welcome to another exciting episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the Brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies. The Brothers Anderson are... This is Eric.
And by the way, you know, when you're telling these little stories, here's a good idea. Have a point. It makes it so much more interesting for the listener.
This is Brother Jay.
You ask me if I have a God complex? Let me tell you something. I am God.
This is true.
There is a storm coming like nothing you have ever seen, and not a one of you is prepared for it.
So sit back, close your eyes, and let us take you away. Unless you're driving, in which case keep your eyes open and watch the road and, you know, anyway.
1-0-5-2-2-5-1-2-1-1-0.
Welcome, this is Eric.
This is Brother Jay.
And tonight, we're springing all the way to 2013 for the John Cusack movie The Number Station. Now, this wasn't on anybody's list. This was kind of a last-minute fill-in that turned out to be a little bit of kismet for me. But I believe you're the one who actually picked it, so take it away, Brother Jay.
I did pick it, because we had just gotten through Gross Point Blank, and unfortunately Drew was not able to join us this evening. So we opted for a string of movies. You threw out some horrible Michael Douglas motorcycle movie that I could not get through the first 3 minutes of.
A New York City cop.
Look out!
On the trail of a killer.
Everybody's on there!
From the back alleys of Manhattan.
Well, our victims are certainly Yakuza.
To the streets of Japan.
Because of your negligence, a man we've wanted for a long time has been lost.
Well, it's not over yet.
Here I am, Nick!
You can get him, boss. You and me.
Michael Douglas, Black Rain.
Was that Black Rain?
Yes.
Okay, I've never seen that. It was available streaming, so I thought, hey, this is an action movie.
Oh, it was terrible. I implore you, go watch the first 5 minutes.
I bet you Andy Garcia isn't even in the first 5 minutes.
He is not.
And he's the one I hate, so.
Oh, it was so bad. I can't. Maybe the rest of the movie is much better. It would almost, by necessity, have to be, but... there's also that stronger chance that it just sucked even worse. So, yeah, pulled the ripcord, found different movies. It gave you several options, but since we just did a Cusack movie, this sounded kind of interesting. And then I fell down the rabbit hole because I did a whole bunch of research online first.
About number stations, I bet.
Number stations that still exist to this day, by the way.
Oh, yeah. No, it's an incredibly... efficient method of communication.
So that link that I sent you, did you have a chance to listen to the documentary?
I think I had heard most of it before, because we had actually talked about number stations before.
Right. I had not listened to the documentary. I was fascinated by it, but it very quickly dispels almost this entire movie as being even possible.
Oh, this movie is ridiculous. Not that it's bad, but it's really ridiculous.
Yeah, no, it is. The movie was fine. The plot was okay, but the believability was just not even on the scale. It wasn't even on the right continent.
Well, yeah, the less you know about number stations, probably the better if you're going to enjoy this movie. Because if you start thinking too much about it, it does really make no sense. In fact, I have questions about this movie for you.
Yes. But this is a perfectly serviceable 90-minute movie. It wasn't anything more than I expected it to be. It wasn't bad. It was actually kind of entertaining. It had some good points. So I was glad I watched it. I'll probably watch it again just to see if I catch anything I didn't the first time. Because I've only seen it once, and I kind of want to absorb it again.
Well, it really does dovetail nicely with Gross Point Blank, because it's the straight version of the comedy. John Cusack plays an assassin.
A bad one.
Not bad, but just an assassin with a lot more conscience than he did. In Gross Point Blank, he was a straight-up sociopath. In this movie, he actually has a conscience, and that gets in the way. And now, I realize that you probably don't draw this straight line, but this has a bit of kismet, because the last couple of podcasts I've talked about my diving through the movies of one Richard Brake. I discovered him for the first time in the movie 31, the Rob Zombie movie, okay, where he was the only juicy character. Everybody else was pretty standard Rob Zombie stuff, but Richard Brake really did a great job as the character Doomhead. And then I watched Perkins 14, which was not a very good horror movie, but he had kind of a nice role in. And then there was Asylum Blackout, where it was a pretty surprisingly good independent horror movie, and he played a role in it that was memorable but not all that huge. But Richard Brake was Max in this movie. He has the best lines of the entire movie.
Yeah.
I mean, he has the line that I'll actually put the whole thing in here, where he's talking to another of the... There's only, like, basically four good guys. Well, perhaps five good guys. Or five protagonists. And then some bad guys. Well, Richard Brake plays Max, one of the bad guys. And at one point, he has a gun held on him by one of the ladies. She is shaking, and so he has the whole line about how...
It doesn't scare me.
Shut the fuck up! Back off!
Please. Let me rephrase that. You think someone like me is afraid of being shot?
Back off!
Meredith, this is between you and I. The rest of these guys, they don't matter. This is just you and me and a choice. You're shaking now. You're getting angry. You're letting your emotions get the better of the situation. The adrenaline is really kicking in. But what I know, the reason that I'm not shaking is because this is a choice not dictated by emotion. This is logic, pure. Simple. My boy over there is rated fourth in the world in the Glock 30. You know what that means? What's it mean?
It means I could shoot you from Texas.
Now, that's of course an exaggeration, but the point stands. He knows what he's doing. He's a professional. And you're... You... You've already dropped the gun. Because this is a choice within a very strict set of parameters. Right now, you're in control. What you don't want to do is put him in control. Don't give him the choice. That way is death. That way is the unconditional and the future choice. That's it. Good girl. I know. It's always a tough lesson to learn. To realize that you don't have the stomach to do what's needed.
Don't kill her.
Of course not.
Which I think is great. He has a great delivery. No, you don't like it?
No, I was trying to find the words for what I thought his dialogue was. It was, I don't want to say it was simplistic, but it was very just kind of pedestrian, very common, very everyday, which wasn't a bad thing, I'm saying. And he tried to be plain spoken in a way that was even, as if to dispel the tension.
Yes. No, he's the negotiator language.
Exactly.
Yes. He's just very even. He's unflappable. He's like, look, you've got a gun on me, but you're not capable of doing this. In fact, at the end, when he says, that's it, you know, it's always a tough lesson to learn to realize that you don't have the stomach to do what's needed.
Yeah. I got distracted greatly at Liam Cunningham's role.
Liam Cunningham was?
Gray.
Gray. Okay. Yes.
Because I recognize him from Game of Thrones.
Yes, indeed.
And so I kept getting distracted by that because it took me a while to figure out where I recognized him from.
Well, and what about Malin Ackerman?
I don't know what I've seen her in. She looked very familiar, but she also looked a little bit like, I just forgot her name. Something about Mary.
Oh, yeah, she has kind of that Cameron Diaz face.
Yes.
Like a little bit of a Pez head.
Yeah.
No, she was in Watchmen.
Oh, I didn't see it.
Yeah, she actually, Watchmen's a pretty good movie. It's a better book, graphic novel.
She played Deborah Harry in CBGB. That's why I recognize her. There we go. Yeah.
She's been a lot of like romantic comedies. Let's see. Oh, she was in Final Girls, which is a pretty good horror movie. But no, she played in Watchmen. I want to get the character's name right because it's important. Although it's funny, it's in the movie, she was unfortunately part of the worst scene in the entire movie. Which was the love scene, which did not need to happen.
At the end?
No, at the beginning. It was kind of in the middle. It's Silk Spectre. She played the younger Silk Spectre.
Oh.
And yeah, it's not great. It took away from the movie.
Gotcha.
So, but I highly recommend the movie if you haven't seen it. I was going to say Haley Joel Osment, but no, Jackie Earle Haley plays Rorschach, and Carla Gugino is in it. She's always great in everything. And Billy Crudup plays Dr. Manhattan, and you get to see his Crudup.
I could find no budget information on this movie.
Oh, they lost money. I read a quote somewhere where maybe the director went into a little bit of director hell. This was his first English language movie.
Oh.
He's a Danish director.
Very.
So he'd done some Danish movies and also some music videos.
This movie had a very different, it did have a different style to it. It was very stylistic, though. It was a pretty movie. It had some very great visuals. The opening was very abstract, though. It was almost like it was a TV show, like a TV series opening.
Oh, most definitely. Yeah. And I like the fact that, you know, once you got this, once the movie got locked down, literally the characters got locked down, it was kind of a siege movie where, you know, it's a very small, defined space, which was great.
Yeah, there weren't a lot of moving parts. But there was some good tension, and it definitely moved along. I don't think there was a lot of slow parts.
Oh, no, it was fine. The pacing was just fine.
But also, it's only 90 minutes long, so it's, you know, they had to get through it.
Yeah. Well, so let's just talk about what a number station is.
So number stations are purportedly, because no one officially talks about them, other than to say, I can neither confirm nor deny that they exist. But purportedly, they are used by clandestine operations to communicate any number of messages to field operatives using coded messages that are then decoded and decrypted, most likely by the use of a one-time pad by the agent who will be in receipt of the message. Messages can be broadcast by radio, so somebody can be hundreds of miles away. Also, the cover of a number station, being that it's on a radio band, lends itself to anonymity because anybody can be listening to a radio. Anybody can have a radio. Having a radio in itself doesn't cause any suspicion. Also, it's impossible to track because it's a one-way signal. It's a one-way communication. So the spy who's in receipt of it, no one can tell who's receiving it unless they're witnessing the actual transcription of numbers. But the number stations generally are set up on lower frequency radio bands. They start usually with some kind of intro opening.
Like a tone?
Some have tones. Some play clocks. Some play chimes. Some play music.
Three, nine, seven, one, five. 39715.
And some just play number sequences in the beginning. And the number sequences in the beginning just repeat as if it was just the same five or six numbers over and over and over again for about 10 minutes. And then after 10 minutes, they will start alternating sequences of numbers, and that's the actual encoded message. And then at the end, there will be a series of 000000, which means end transmission. So there's several of these still active around the world, the theory being that any government who has them is going to keep it running constantly, regardless, even if it's just garbage that they're transmitting, because having it operate constantly doesn't allow anybody to be able to get the perception that there's increased traffic if there is actual traffic going. So if suddenly they need to transmit special secret wartime instructions, since they're already transmitting every hour on the hour, no one's any the wiser that there's suddenly different traffic, because the volume doesn't ever change. The frequency doesn't change.
Exactly. And you can set it up where you hear the tones and then you hear the numbers in, again, whatever language you want. And the idea is that way you can, if you're in the field, you can tune your radio and make sure that you're on the right frequency for when you actually need it.
And because they most likely employ the use of one-time pads are the most secure of communications, because it is encrypted once with one cipher key, and then that cipher key is destroyed and never used again. So it's impossible to break that kind of code, because you don't have the cipher to decrypt it, to break it again. So it becomes a very, very secure means, and obviously it's one way. And the theory is that there are machines at the transmitter base to which the numbers are transmitted to. So there's no human involved at a number station at the point where there's a transmittal. The person who's creating the message encrypts it and then sends the encrypted message in numbers to the machine. That's most likely done remotely, either by telecommunications or some kind of electronic transmission. Also, it's very unlikely that anybody who's doing the encoding is even remotely involved with the actual entering of the message. And the message itself is transmitted by an electromechanical means. There's not somebody actually reading numbers.
Well,
there may be somebody recording it at some point, but most of the number stations now are automated, where they may have been recorded in series at some point, but they're strung together now in an automated fashion.
Oh yeah, no, you can actually, I mean, you know, it's just like the phone company. You know, if you get an error message, there is, you know, not, there used to be a time where people would actually record, you know, you've received, you know, this is, subject is not reachable, error 345. But now you just type that out, and some voice actor maybe a long time ago had read all of the number combinations or all the parts of the number combinations. So you type what you want and the automated thing speaks it out. I mean, now we have a lot more sophisticated text to speech programs. But
well, and in the case of
the good old days, you could just use text to speech way back in the 60s and 70s, I think.
And in the case of, I believe it's the Lincolnshire Poacher number station, the last digit has an upward inflection. So they recorded a series of numbers and then recorded a second series of numbers that go with it. So there's a very specific pattern and a very specific tone and meter.
Like you couldn't just come on, like you couldn't tune your home transmitter system and just say 597265, because you would sniff out, the field agent would sniff out that that's not a correct transmission.
Also, the opening cipher would probably not match the number to identify the page of the one-off pad.
Exactly.
So it's interesting and fascinating. It was also fascinating to understand the link that I sent you, which I'm assuming you'll include in the notes. the BBC program that discussed it actually talks about one of the reasons they stopped airing live recordings of Big Ben during the war, because it used to be when Big Ben would chime, they would play that live on the radio. They stopped doing it because, as it turns out, that recording, although it wasn't a recording, it was live at the time, gave data to the enemy, because the enemy could get all kinds of weather information from the audio, because the sound of the bell through damp air or rain would be obscured or sound differently and resonate differently. So they could tell how much rain, if there was clouds, etc. And so they recorded Big Ben, and then they played the recordings from there on out.
So, yeah, so you wouldn't, it would be to your disadvantage to have somebody speaking into a microphone.
Yes.
Okay, so let's just talk about the plot of the movie, because this is where this breaks down. So the plot of the movie is actually a pretty simple thing. We have John Cusack, who plays a guy named Emerson, who is an assassin.
And Emerson Kent, so his name is backwards.
And his partner or his boss, depending on the perspective, is Michael Gray, Liam Cunningham. And in the very beginning, you see that he assassinates this guy, but then can't assassinate a witness who happens to... I think it's in my notes, it says it's the daughter.
Yeah.
Yeah. So whether or not it's related to the person he killed, it doesn't matter. He's supposed to... His job as an assassin is to get rid of everyone who's a witness. So right. His partner kills a girl, and so he is taken off of assassin assignment and sent to a desk job. And the desk job happens to be this number station in England, where he is assigned to a code announcer by the name of Catherine, played by Malin Ackerman. And the best I can understand is his job is to be security for the base. Her job is to read the numbers. The plot would indicate that she has a much more sophisticated job than just reading the numbers, but I can't figure out why that would have to be.
Well, and in reality, at a number station, you would never have that be. You would never have an operative with such advanced skill in encryption decryption at a site that was transmitting and possibly ever in peril. You would have those assets in the most safe place and secure place you ever could imagine, just so you couldn't ever infiltrate or exfiltrate them.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. I mean, you can have a number station being a big radio transmitter, and you can have like Johnny, the maintenance man, who makes sure that the transmitter still works properly. But that person would basically be a radio engineer or an electrician. It would not be anybody who had any knowledge of codes.
Right. You would just have some lackey who would be punching codes into a console.
Yeah, or even not. I mean,
right.
Maybe, I mean, yeah, it seems like the less human element, the better.
And one of the machines that they show online is actually looks like a giant, strange typewriter, teletype, cathode ray tube machine where they just probably input either on paper tape or punch cards, because it's probably, you know, 1950s technology. Because it doesn't have to be sophisticated. It's just spouting out numbers that are preordained.
Oh, no. Ideally, the beauty of it is it's not sophisticated. I mean, right. It's very elegant, but it doesn't have very many moving parts, like even computer parts necessarily. You can actually have it just be a person whose job it is to every hour say some numbers. The problem is that she does not require. I mean, the conceit of this movie is that she's got the key. She has the code for her shift, and he is protecting her because she knows the code.
Well,
she should not be doing any cryptography. She should not be encoding anything.
Well, and as it turns out, it's actually his job is not to protect her. Her job is to kill her if there's ever a breach.
Yeah, yeah. His job is not to protect her. You're right. His job is to protect the station.
That's
right. Which means, if necessary, he kills her, any threat to the station, and destroys the station.
Yes.
Which also makes him of all the people that are supposed to be important, he is the most important, and yet he... I mean, why even keep him?
From the get-go, he is the weakest link of anybody.
Oh, yes. Most definitely.
Now, it doesn't turn out to be the weakest link, obviously, but, you know, the beginning of this movie sets up very well that he's damaged.
Oh, yeah.
And again, and not a lot of depth, but when he starts in the movie, when he and Gray are in the car and they're talking about how the body's only worth $4, and he's using a one-time pad, which I appreciated, as he's decrypting his message and going forward. But then he goes to the oddest, strangest bar I've ever seen.
Yeah.
It just seemed really out of place and incomplete. And I don't know. It was clearly somebody's condo. So, and he botches the hit and gets away, which is, you know, continuing his trend of being a bad hitman.
Well, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. He's not a good hitman.
Yeah.
So ideally what should have happened was in the very beginning, before the credits, I think before the credits, though. Basically, Michael Gray, his boss, should have killed the witness and then him.
Yes.
Left him on the field. And that way he's taken care of his personnel problem and he walks away. But no, for some reason they need to keep him, which is silly. And again, Catherine, the code announcer person, who ostensibly her entire job is just to read numbers, which later in the movie... he reads numbers, so it defeats that whole thing. Also, they have this some supercomputer there that does code, changes his messages. Okay, so again, this movie, which was, like I said, it was perfectly pleasant to watch if you weren't thinking about it.
Right.
The problem is when you do think about it, the idea
is... it falls apart.
The bad guys are trying to break in to send messages...
like to fake, send operatives into motion.
Yeah, to send operatives into motion. Basically, they've got a hit list of 15 people that they discover this later that's what they've done, is they've sent out basically hits on these agents, these assets or whatever. So these assassination orders have already gone out. They were put out falsely by the last crew, right? Or were they put out falsely by Catherine?
Say that again.
Okay, so when Emerson and Catherine get to start their shift...
right.
They're attacked. They get inside. Have the hit orders already been given out? Yeah, they must have.
Yes.
Okay. So they were given out by the other team, by their opposites, the other announcer and the other security person. Yeah.
The day team.
Yeah. So the day team has already given out the bad orders. Therefore, they use the day team's code. Catherine doesn't know the code.
Right.
So she can't undo it. Also, okay, the whole thing to this movie is that she is somehow able to get the code and then can send out messages to cancel the hit orders, and you know, there's a lot of yada yada in between that's really fun, don't get me wrong, but
that's the thing, is she's able to get the code because the other operative leaves the messages in other messages. Because she had a cryptographic background, too.
Yeah, so she has enough information to get the code, which means it's not a very good code.
No. And if you were dealing with a bunch of cryptographers who are so sophisticated, isn't that the first thing you would check and delete everything?
Also, so let's say you're Johnny Spy out with your shortwave radio, you know, polishing your guns or whatever. And so you get the message from the day team saying, you need to go kill Michael Gray, spoiler. And then you're going to sit by your radio for the evening team to give you the cancel order? Like, you're off in motion, right?
Right. You're already in action.
Yeah, you're George Clooney off testing out your guns and getting ready in Italy or Spain or whatever that's supposed to be. You're the American.
Unless there's some built-in kind of redundancy where you have to have a confirmation.
Which they did not explain in the exposition.
Exactly. I'm saying there's a lot of parts to where this movie just falls apart.
Because the idea is the number station is not sending out cell phone calls. You're not calling Brother Jay and saying, Brother Jay, complete task A.
Right.
And then you're in the middle of figuring out how to complete task A, and you get a phone call saying, oh, abort. No, it's not that kind of system.
Yeah, it's not a person-to-person call. It's a one-way. It's a one-way thing. That's what makes it secure.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it would be traceable. That's the BBC program makes it point clear. When you have cell phone transmissions or email transmissions, or even postal mail transmissions, you can find out who the contacts are just by following.
Exactly.
A number station, you can't follow anything. Yeah. The best you can hope for is to pinpoint the transmitter with radio directing technology that can follow the radio signal back to its source, but that doesn't gain you anything either. Knowing where the source is doesn't help you with the exception of knowing a radius.
Well, you can triangulate a position to find out where the transmitter is. The actual where your asset is somewhere in the field that you can't triangulate.
And the likelihood is the asset is hiding in plain sight. The asset is going to be amongst hundreds, if not thousands, if not millions of people.
Yeah, exactly.
Just to be able to give anonymity.
Yeah, well, so anybody knowing, with a shortwave radio, without even, depending on how far you are away, even without a sophisticated antenna, you can pick up shortwave transmissions, they bounce off the ionosphere. You can get those thousands of miles away.
Right.
And with a big enough antenna, you can pick up, if you have some sort of Unabomber shack with an antenna on it, you can be picking that up, around the world. It's a ham radio setup.
Sure. Know?
And again, all you'd have to do is tune to that particular frequency, and all you get is a bunch of numbers. And if you don't have the key, you're not going to know what the code is. I mean, you're not going to be able to figure it out.
Might as well just be written in another language. In fact, it is written in another language. Yeah,
exactly. And since you don't know who is the recipient of that, you don't even know where to start looking.
And even if you could find them, you still wouldn't know what the message was.
Well, yeah. I mean, if on 912... You could, if you had somebody, some computer somewhere recording all the number stations on 912, you could try to listen back maybe to figure out where it came from. But even if you could figure it out and decode it, which maybe you could after the fact, it won't help you because the next attack will be a different code.
Right.
And again, it would, maybe the transmitter would be the same place. But again, I mean, I guess you could bomb the transmitter, but then all the enemy loses is a transmitter and maybe a couple of employees who are technicians.
Yeah, there's no high-level operatives at a number station.
Yeah.
There's barely probably even people.
Yeah, it's a radio shack.
Yeah. So the fact that this was a military installation that had gone defunct and they had repurposed it was nice cinematography, but not very practical.
Well, it may very well be a real thing because, again, in England, you have lots of, they have all of those bunkers from World War II. And so there's lots of areas where you could put in secret installations and, hide antennas and things. But again, yeah, that's just window dressing. You could also have a number station at the top of a high rise or... any place you could have, that big antenna array by Chernobyl could be a number station, except it turns out it wasn't.
It wasn't very covert because they have a garage door opener that opens double gates, which are motorized. So there's that's fine, but they park out in the open.
Well, exactly. So, it seems like you would pull into one of those missile base silo things.
You would never leave your car out and exposed. So. Just for the very reason that, as later we see, one of the cars has a bomb planted in it.
Yeah, also you should have an alternate escape plan, too, that doesn't involve going outside and driving your own car away. But hey, what do we know? We're quibbling. Right. Again, if you don't think too hard about these things, the movie is fine. And by the way, just spoiler here also, he remains a poor agent throughout the entire movie. The only reason he is the least bit likable in this movie is he is not good at his job.
Or he's unwilling to do his job.
Well, and also at the very end of the movie, again, we don't know how to say have to give it away, but his boss should kill him again at the end of this movie.
Yeah.
So overall, if you were to give it a grade, I realize this is a short talk about a short movie. What's your verdict?
I'd give it a B.
Yeah.
It had plenty of action. It kept moving. It kept my interest. It was fine, and it was a fine, serviceable movie. But you're right. You have to suspend your knowledge of number stations. Otherwise, it makes no sense. But as an action, adventure, espionage thriller, it was just fine. It was fine. It wasn't too long. It never really stuttered. It never stumbled too much. There were some parts that in the beginning when Kent Emerson, his name is reversed, but when Emerson is struggling with the fact that he was right next to this teenage girl that was murdered, and he's basically fallen off the wagon and drinking himself to sleep every night. That was a good performance from Miss John Cusack.
Oh, absolutely.
Yep. There was a little bit of realism when Catherine and Emerson are outside of the bunker and the explosion goes off and they're both thrown to the ground, covered in shrapnel, injured, and unable to hear.
I love when a movie does that.
That was a nice, realistic kind of explosion. Although I suspect they would have been much more injured. But regardless, they make the point very easily, very early on, that the bunker codes change at every shift. So that was the thing.
Well, and so my overall thought was, yeah, I thought it was a great Richard Brake movie. His best. It should go on his highlight reel. Because he has that one speech.
Who knew that MacBook Airs were the encryptor's choice?
Exactly, yes. He might as well have the by Menon. In his bathroom when he went to his aftershave or something.
But it had that trapped kind of trapped in a cave, trapped in a mine, trapped in a submarine kind of feel to it.
Oh, yeah.
They're enclosed in this bunker and ostensibly somebody is loose and killing people.
I would like to see the number station stage play. Because you could do that. It's a very small set.
It was a very small set.
You could do it all as a one-act play. It could also be radio play. It's Pontypool, except instead of zombies, you've got these, ambiguous bad agent guys. Like, it's a standard plot. And John Cusack is John Cusack. He does a good job. I mean, hopefully he got paid a decent amount of money. This movie did not make any money. I don't think it had a very wide theater release at all, if any, in America. It could have gone straight to video.
I was going
to
say, I'd never heard of it before.
Well, I had heard of it, and actually I had rented it on Netflix before. And when you mentioned it, I was like, ooh, I remember starting this movie and not stopping it. Not finishing it. But then, on assignment, watching it, it actually was fine. And like I said, I think it must have been a mood thing for me.
Yeah, there is a lot of suspension of any kind of reality in operation in this. So the double cross didn't. I wrote, oh, it's a double cross. Where's M. Night Shyamalan when you need him?
Well, yeah. And, this isn't the fact that there are people in bunkers who do these clandestine things is still a thing, there may be military people who are in bunkers are in the position of launching nuclear assets, and under our current president this seems more likely every day. And I think in Swimming to Cambodia, Spalding Gray comes across one of these guys who said he's in a underground waterproof bunker in Kansas someplace. And Spalding Gray asks him why it's waterproof. And then he goes on. It's a very, very good part of Swimming to Cambodia. I'm a big fan of Spalding Gray. Swimming to Cambodia, Monster in a Box, and Grey's Anatomy in particular. Yeah, so I thought, great Richard Brake movie. Yeah, a pedestrian but serviceable John Cusack movie. Everybody else is ultimately forgettable, I think. I think B, maybe B minus.
Yeah. It was, like I said, I'm interested to watch it again, not real soon. I want to wait a bit, but I'm going to watch it again at some point just to see if I get a different take of it. Boyfriend Jesse fell asleep within the first 10 minutes of it, so that tells you what he thought of it.
Yeah, see, that's kind of what I did the first time I watched it, too. So maybe this is one you have to be in the right frame of mind for.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, so.
It's no Fourth Protocol.
We have to see Fourth Protocol.
I swear we already did Fourth Protocol.
Drew talked about it. He has fond memories of Fourth Protocol. You and Drew talked about it, I think. But I don't think we've seen it. I haven't seen it.
Okay.
I mean, I've seen it, but I haven't seen it for this through the podcast. So.
All right.
Although we're getting to the point where it's very possible I forgot we had an episode on that. So, yeah. Which is, again, a good problem to have.
Yeah, because we're almost up to 200.
We are. Oh, we're very nearly at 200. Let me actually find out for the
187 is.
Well, that's the number, but remember we have a bunch of other episodes. So let me see how many are available now. Oh, we're looking at 202. So technically we're over 200 episodes. I know I took Tiptoes off. You can't. That's not available for download anymore.
I must say that the supercut of Wolfgang, Boyfriend Jesse thought was the funniest thing he's heard. So.
Oh, Heidi, your gravy is too close. Oh, Heidi, you got a great ass. Oh, Heidi got sticky. Oh, Heidi, I am God. Oh, Heidi, you're too black. Heidi's on it. Oh, Heidi, shut your mouth. Oh, Heidi, that's a great movie, but no great ass. Oh, Heidi, you need a Kleenex. Oh, Heidi, your singing is so gross. Oh, that aspirin will take your headache away. Oh, Anna, your gravy is too thick. Oh, Heidi, we have to have a tiebreaker. Oh, Heidi, your point is so gross. Oh, Heidi, your balloons are too red. Oh, Heidi, auf Wiedersehen. Oh, Heidi, your joke is too flat. Oh, Heidi, your candidate is too scaly.
Well, wait till you hear the supercut of all of our outtakes. Because that's like 7 minutes long.
Jesus.
And it's just goofy stuff we say, but it makes me laugh so much. And in fact, I think maybe, because didn't I do like a group of outtakes after episode 100 or something?
Yes.
So I can, if I added those, I think it's almost 10 minutes of outtakes.
Well, you should definitely cobble them together.
Oh,
yeah. It should be cumulative.
Absolutely, yeah. So at episode 200... because I think we did an episode 100, right? That didn't have a movie? Yeah. So we'll do episode 200. So start thinking now about things you want to talk about for episode 200. If we want to reminisce, talk about things that didn't work, talk about things that did work, talk about the future.
Top secret.
Of the, things that didn't work.
The podcast that was 0.5.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because one of the things that I can talk about that didn't work is doing different numbering systems. Why would I have music? I mean, even the music episodes don't need to be different numbers. I could just put a list on the website. The website, actually, once I get it filled in, which is going to take some work, but we have, the last 30 or 40 episodes and then the first 10 or 15 episodes all on the website that I think looks pretty sleek. Okay, so are we on to housekeeping?
Sure.
Okay. Are you a Food Network fan?
I used to be. When they actually had cooking shows. Now that it's contest shows, I barely watch Cooking Network. The Food Network, sorry.
Have you seen the show Bakers versus Fakers?
No.
Have you heard of the show Cooks versus Cons?
Yes.
Okay. Bakers versus Fakers is the same thing except with baking.
Okay.
And so the idea is you have four contestants, two of which are professional bakers and two of which have some other profession. But they're all dressed up in chef's outfits and they're all given a task. And so the judges are judging them on the quality of whatever they prepare, but also on their technique to see if they can figure out who's the faker and who's the baker. And, it's edited, I'm sure, to make it more entertaining, obviously.
Naturally.
My lovely wife had instantly when I had the show on, and instantly she said, Jason needs to apply for this. He needs to do it. He's like, no. She's like, you could totally be the faker because you have baking skills. He's like, you need to figure out how to apply for it because you could pull it off.
I'm flattered. I will look into it.
She's eaten enough of your desserts to say if it's possible, you should apply for it just for the experience of applying.
I will look into it.
Also, the fun part of it is that at the very end, there's one winner, right? And if the winner is a baker, they get $10,000 as their prize. If nice. The winner is a faker, they get $15,000 as a prize.
Yeah.
So that'd be awesome. If you could put out a cheesecake in 45 minutes that had some kind of cheese nips in it, which I'm confident you could do. If nothing else, take it as a compliment. But seriously, figure out. They may very well have like auditions for those kind of programs in Portland because you live in a very hip city.
That's true. I live in a very foodie city.
Exactly. So they would not necessarily have tryouts for that in some place like, oh, I don't know, Los Anchorage.
Yeah, I get it. I'll certainly take a look. But to go back to your question on the Food Network, I used to love the Food Network when they cooked. Now there's almost no cooking on the Food Network. And I had hoped for the Cooking Channel when it started, because they had cooking, but they're also now getting away from cooking and they're all about travel.
Exactly, yes.
So I appreciate that, but I understand you got to go where the ratings are, but it just disappoints me. So I am super glad that for Christmas this year, last year, 2016, I asked Mom who had my name. I'm like, I only want Alton Brown cookbooks for Christmas. So, and I have been using them. So
Excellent. It's
nice to go back to basics and go back to the Good Eats episodes. And it's kind of nostalgic. And so I miss those days of Good Eats and, Emerald Live and Iron Chef before there was Iron Chef America.
Well, or even just the shows where you had, I can't remember her name. She was blonde, but she just did like basic cooking stuff.
Like Melissa D'Arabian or?
No, I mean, I think Sandra something or.
Oh, Sandra D. Yeah, she did Semi Homemade.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay, that must be her. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Just like a normal Midwest mom.
Yeah.
Because who's like a professional chef, like Alex Guarnaschelli. I have a fondness of now only because I watched her on that next Iron Chef or whatever. She and who is the German lady that I didn't like on Chopped, but I found a tremendous affection.
Is she the one who always does the judging on the cake shows?
No, I can't remember her name, but she's like a blonde and she's. She's got sort of pointy features.
Is she younger or older?
She's like Alex Guarnaschelli age. Maybe her name starts with an A or it has an A in it or something. Actually, here, I'll just look up Chopped. She was definitely a...
Don't get me started on Chopped.
Amanda Freitag.
Oh, Amanda Freitag. Yeah,
yeah.
I like her.
Yeah, I didn't like her until I saw her on... Because I didn't like her as a judge... I don't like Aaron Sanchez as a judge either. Because
Chris Santos makes me want to, I just want to put a shovel through his head.
Well, and that's the thing is that that's his character. I realized early that that's, they're making
my
up
problem,
characters.
My problem, now we've just descended into this. My problem with the Chopped show, I used to really like it. And then, first of all, the only dessert people make, ice cream, bread pudding, or pain perdu.
Yeah, which is hilarious. Well, because you only have a half an hour. What are you going to do?
Who cares? God, make something else. But fine. But my problem with the judges on Chopped is that when they're debating and they're talking to the chefs, one of them will be, this is oversalted. The next one will be, this is not seasoned well enough. Now, those both can't be true statements. Or, if they're both true statements, you have to account for the fact that your palates are so different that you can't judge equally, which is unfair. Also, on almost every household in this country, I will guarantee you there's a damn salt shaker. You can always add salt if it doesn't have it, but you cannot take it away if there's too much. So I credit the chef with knowing not to oversalt something as opposed to getting something that's so salty I can't eat it. But my other rant about Chopped, which a show is I really rather like, as opposed to Cutthroat Kitchen, which I can't stand, which Alton Brown loves, by the way. He loves that show.
It's just, Cutthroat Kitchen is an exercise in
mean.
It's mean, and it's also not preparing good food.
No, it's not about preparing good food.
Yeah.
It's about being mean, which is fine, but I don't have any desire to watch it. My problem with Chopped is that they will have competition then. They will bring people back for these redemption shows, and then they will have semifinals and quarterfinals and finals. If that's going to be the case, then each of those shows need to have the same damn ingredients, and you need to put them on an even field. If you have semifinals and you have three shows of semifinals where you have 12 contestants competing to get to quarterfinals, you need all three of those semifinals need to cook the same damn ingredients.
Yeah, because, you know, somebody's going to get like chicken livers and somebody else is going to get durian, and that's not fair.
Exactly. So that's my Chopped rant. I almost never watch, and never watch anymore. Rachel Ray, I really loved her in the beginning in the beginning of the days of the Food Network, Rachel Ray had this dining on $30 a day show, which I adored.
No, it was $40 a day, but it might as well have been 30 because she always spent like 12 on booze.
The thing I love that show. And then she went to her 30-minute meals and then I hated her. I had a visceral response.
Oh no!
Because she was just also fucking Rachel Ray of Sunshine.
Well, I'll give you four letters and a heaping helping of bile in your throat when she starts saying EVOO or YUMO. It's like, oh come on! I know people want to do that, and hey, I think Rachel Ray is great.
And I like Rachel Ray just fine, but after a while she got annoying, and then she had a talk show, and then, you know, she's big on Pitbull, so it's hard to hate her, but I just
sometimes I don't hate her. I don't want to push her down the stairs. Fine. Yeah. No, I think she's fine. I mean, you know, I realize that it's all about showbiz. It's interesting. I mean, I think Anthony Bourdain, he's kind of grown old for me too. Like, he became too much of a thing. Like, I love Kitchen Confidential, the book, and I love, I like his travel shows. I don't love it, because he does a lot of that adventure eating. Like, you know, and we're gonna
have possum cooked in a popcorn popper.
You know, it's funny. He says in Kitchen Confidential something that I really like. He's like, you know, knowing what I know about working in kitchens for many years, he's like, I don't eat seafood on Monday. And frankly, I don't eat oysters or shellfish ever because I don't know where they come from and they can truly make you sick. So if I am a foreign country that prepares some sort of delicacy in a way that I will not get in America, I will be happy to eat your oysters. But I'm not going to go to Manhattan and order oysters at an oyster bar because I have no idea if I'm going to get tremendously sick afterward.
Yeah.
So I think that's news you could use.
Yeah.
But I don't want to see him go and eat like snake gonads or something. It's not.
Scorpions in a bowl of ice cream.
Oh, a girl at work just came back from Cambodia. And I have a video that she posted on Facebook. I mean, I don't have it, but it's on Facebook. Where she ate a tarantula and she also ate some sort of beetle. They gave her like 100 baht to eat the tarantula, which is like about $2.75. So she actually made money on that. But I have no desire to eat tarantula on a stick, even in a foreign country.
Yeah.
Like, I went to France and ate a royale with cheese 3 times. Because yeah. As Terry's husband says, I ain't eating no scrotums by accident.
Fair point.
Yeah. Only eat scrotums on purpose.
Send your feedback to show@notinthecreepyway.com or call us on our new voicemail account
to leave voice messages, or you can text us at this account to leave text messages. The number is 425-243-9169. That's 425-243-9169. What are you waiting for? Put it in your phone right now, and then when you listen to an episode, you can just hit your contacts. Dial it already.